Is this a baseball town?
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the ballpark.
My name is Ryan Lefevre. God gave me everything I wanted just to show me it wasn't what I needed.
On the ground to Hosmer. Davis to the bag. Magic number zero. The Royals are the 2015 American League Central Division champions.
On the outside, life was more than I could have imagined.
Swinging a ground ball to third is fair. Fair ball.
On the inside, I was falling apart. I was suffering from major depressive disorder. No accomplishment or relationship was going to heal me. I needed help.
Here's the 2-2 pitch. Swing and a high fly ball right field. Should be deep enough. Granderson gets behind it. He makes the catch. Escobar tags. Escobar to the plate. He is safe. And the Royals take game one.
It was like taking game one first. One step at a time, one day at a time, healing one wound at a time.
Strike three call! It's over! They've done it! The Royals are World Series champions! The world champion Kansas City Royals!
With the help of others, and by the grace of God, I am here today.
Broadcasters should know how to turn a microphone on. Thank you. Two things about that video. Number one, I am not as cool as that video is. Every time it's played, I can't help but sit back and be like, who's that guy? That's not me up there. And number two, I have to update that video. Those were 10 years ago already. Can you believe that? We're going to celebrate 10 years since the Royals won the World Series, and so I'm going to have to add some new highlights to that after making the playoffs last year. I go to Arizona in 26 days for the 2025 baseball season, and I'm happy to be here. I'm grateful to be here. If there's a takeaway today, I want you to know this, that the reason many of you are here today, I understand, is because of my job. And you're probably wondering if the guy you listen to all summer can put a sentence together without a baseball game in front of him. But my story that I'm about to share with you today is not a remarkable story at all. And I see so many men in here, and it's so encouraging because in my church back in Kansas City, which is a newer, thriving church, the biggest struggle in that church and many other churches is men's ministry. And just getting men together to talk about manly things, talk about our struggles as men in the world today, our struggles to be a good husband and a good father. So I hope the takeaway when you leave today is that I'm like you, that I would go to this breakfast if there was a speaker because he might say something that would encourage me or his story might relate to my story. I have several small groups in Kansas City. I have two guys that I've met with for almost 20 years. I have a Bible study group. I'm one of five guys, and I have a small group, which is about one of six or seven guys. And I can tell you that I don't go to those things because they need me. I go to those things because I need them. And so anytime I see a group of men that are willing to come and humble themselves on a weekend after a long week of work to have fellowship and maybe learn something from that person, it's really encouraging to me because there was a time in my life where I wouldn't have gone to something like this because I would have been too ashamed to come through the door, or you know, it felt like, you know, the church would have started on fire if I had walked through the door because of some of the things that I had done or how I felt about myself. But I'm not a pastor, I'm not a professional counselor. I study the Bible, but I'm not a Bible scholar. The only thing I'm licensed to do is drive a car in Missouri. So You need to know that up front. I also want you to know that I'm also the biggest loser, which was confirmed this past baseball season. You see, last year was my 30th year as a major league broadcaster, which I know sounds crazy to you because I'm only 37 years old, so you do the math. But in my career, and we'll just go with the Royals, 26 years with the Royals, 5 winning seasons, 90 or more losses, 15 seasons. That's 58% of the seasons that I've had here have been 90 losses or more. 100 or more losses in 7 seasons. That's more than 1 in 4 we've lost 100 games. So people within the organization would say, you got to have like one of the worst winning percentages for a broadcaster in Major League history. And we joked about that for years. And so we finally did the research last year. And the qualifier was a broadcaster had to be with one team for 25 or more years. And it took forever. We went team by team. And finally, we had all the broadcasters from every team, 25 or more years. Then you can plug in their years and the winning percentage. I have the worst winning percentage for a team broadcaster in Major League history. Thank you. And I went to back-to-back World Series, and I have a championship. So, and really, that is the story of my life. If you summed up, my life has been a lot of 90 lost seasons and 100 lost seasons. But in the middle of that, enough back-to-back years where God has been gracious to me and put me in a position where I'm here today. I also want you to know that I'm here today because I had no choice. And I'll explain. I was born in Los Angeles, California. In fact, a lot of these wildfires are in my neighborhood. And my family's long since moved out of Southern California, but I'd say about 70% of my friends lived in the Palisades area. We lived in Santa Monica, we lived in Brentwood, so all these streets in these areas I'm very familiar with, and I get the tally on the phone from some buddies of mine, so-and-so's parents' house is gone, that I spent time in my childhood. So that was my stomping grounds. My father, Jim Lefever, played for the Los Angeles Dodgers. He was Rookie of the Year in 1965, won a World Series in 65, played in the golden era of baseball. I mean, he played with Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale. He played against Willie Mays. He played against Hank Aaron. He played against Bob Gibson. He has great stories to tell about that era of his life. My mom was a model and very successful in real estate, and I would tag along with her to showings in Beverly Hills and Bel Air, and she was buying and selling homes with the rich and famous all of the time. So I grew up in an era, in a part of the world, part of the country, with a lot of image. My parents separated when I was 18 months old. I never saw my mom and dad together. And I was an only child until I was 13 when I started having half siblings. And I spent most of my childhood wondering where I belonged. I had a famous name in Los Angeles in the 70s and the 80s, Lefever. I mean, first of all, it's a unique name. People ask me all the time, is that a stage name, Lefever? And I was like, well, you haven't seen how it's spelled. But no, it's not a stage name. But I grew up very unattached, if you will, and just always searching for where do I belong, where am I loved. My parents hated each other, so anytime they interacted, it was painful, and I didn't have any siblings to lean on, so it was a very difficult period of my life. And so, like a lot of adolescents, teens who are without direction, we find our own direction, and mine was not a very good one. I started drinking pretty heavily when I was 14 years old. I lost my virginity when I was 14 years old. I was involved in a few car accidents, serious car accidents. One of these canyons that you've been hearing about with the wildfires in Brentwood, I rolled down with my high school girlfriend. And I to this day, I mean, if I listen and think very clearly, I can still hear her yelling my name and crying as her body is thumping against the car as we are rolling down, and the car ended up upside down in the street. And then her father came. And here's her daughter, and here's me, and a car upside down in the street. So where I turned for love was alcohol, chasing girls, and trying to succeed in sports. And fortunately, I had some success in sports. I went to the University of Minnesota on a baseball scholarship. This has not been confirmed, but I'm pretty sure I'm the only person in the history of the country to go from Los Angeles to Minnesota to play baseball, but I did. And had a nice career there and broke some records. I played 4 years there. I was drafted by Cleveland. I played 2 weeks and realized I was done playing baseball. That's a longer story, but I realized that my heart was calling me somewhere else. And so I got into broadcasting, and that was not an accident. That was a high-profile image, doing a game on TV and immediately going to the sports bar and knowing that everybody just saw me up on that screen and walking through the doors and hoping that someone would recognize me, maybe buy me a drink, maybe an attractive girl and her friend might come over and start a conversation with me. I mean, it just fed the monster. I got a job with the Minnesota Twins when I was 24 years old. I was the youngest broadcaster in the major leagues for 4 years. As I said in the video, and I stole that line from someone else, but God literally gave me everything I wanted just to show me it wasn't what I needed. In the winter of 1998, I was getting ready for my fourth year as a Twins broadcaster. And remember, I'd gone to the University of Minnesota, which is in Minneapolis. My college coach would bring me back to speak to the team at least once a year, and he would introduce me in this way. This is Ryan. They all knew who I was because I had just played there a few years before that, and they saw me doing Twins and University of Minnesota sports on TV. He took a chance and left California to come here to play baseball, and he broke all these records, and he had a chance to play professional baseball, but he realized that wasn't for him. So he used the resources he had as a Division I athlete to meet people in the broadcasting field. He put in the time, he put in the work, and this is an example of someone who didn't make it as a major leaguer, because, of course, everybody wants to make it to the major leagues when you're playing college baseball, but he used this experience to turn into this. In the winter of 1998, I had to go talk to my former coach and explain to him why I got into a fist fight with one of his players at a bar on campus. And I would say, even though I'm about to turn 54 next month, that's probably the most humiliated I've ever felt in my life. Because here's this guy that he would bring back and use as an example to encourage the players about what you can do with your life. And I have to explain to him why I got into a fight with one of his players at a bar. And that was the last time I drank. And the reason why I have no choice about being here today is because that was January 25th, 1998. So 27 years ago. Today. Thank you. So that was good news at first, because Ryan was doing a lot fewer dumb things when I quit drinking. But after I faced my coach, I had to face a mentor of mine in the broadcasting business. And he said two things to me that really changed the course of my life. And I was making excuses. Well, you know, he started it, and you know, I shouldn't even been there, and my buddies wanted me to go there, and blah, blah, blah. You know, excuses, 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 excuses. To which he said, "Let me ask you a question. What are you pretending not to know?" And And I had to wrap my brain around that for a while. What are you pretending not to know? If something is not going right in your life right now and you keep hitting the same wall, what are you pretending not to know? And as I was trying to figure that out, he said, and you need to know what people in this market think about you. They see you as a young man with a lot of talent and very little character. Whew. So I got to explain to my coach why I got into a drunken fight with one of his players, and then I get this from a mentor of mine who was a talk show host in Minneapolis. What are you pretending not to know? Well, I was pretending not to know that I had a drinking problem. Alcohol and I were not getting along and operating in the community very well. And I tell people now when they offer me, and they don't know, they offer me a drink or something, I say, you know what? I used up all my drink tickets a long time ago. But people see you as someone with very little character. Now, that day I got on a bus with some Twins players, and we went from Minneapolis across the state in our winter caravan, and we made stops at a children's hospital, at an American Legion, at a radio station, just to promote the upcoming baseball season on our way back to Minneapolis. And on that trip across the state, and I was a man, I would have considered myself at that time a man of faith and prayer, but this was the first time that I had an on-my-knees moment in that bus, sitting by myself, so ashamed of who I was and what I had done with what had been given to me. And I asked God to help me become a man of character. January 25th, 1998. I didn't know what that meant. I had an idea. I didn't know what that looked like. But that was my prayer. Help me become a man of character. I had one more year with the Twins. I came here to the Royals in 1999. I was single. I wasn't drinking, but I didn't realize that that was my medicine. That was my coping, self-medication, dealing with the insecurities that I had as a little boy. Where am I loved? Who cares about me? Where do I belong? And I'm in Kansas City. And for those of you, you know, this will be my 27th year with the Royals. And I'm going to turn 54, so I can officially say that I've been a Royals broadcaster for half my life, and I've lived in Kansas City longer than I've lived anywhere else in my life. But when I first got here, I was sitting in Fred White's chair, and Fred White and Denny Matthews were an institution here for 25 years. And so you can say whatever you want about me and my career now with the Royals, but back then, I was some 28-year-old from Minnesota who had no ties to this region at all. And people loved and still love Fred White. I mean, for many of you, that's the voice of your childhood with the Royals and K-State and college basketball. And so it was a lonely time for me. And without alcohol, I had to deal with what led to my bad behaviors. And that's when the depression began. And by the time I was 30 years old, I had the job I wanted, making the money I wanted, the car I wanted to drive, the house I wanted to live, everything I wanted. And I was more unhappy with all of that stuff than I was before I got all of it. So now what am I going to do? God gave me everything I wanted just to show me it wasn't what I needed. Well, what do I want then? And it all came to a head in August of 2005 when in the closet of my master bedroom in a five-bedroom house on a lake in Kansas City where I lived by myself, I was in the fetal position, crying out for the comfort of my mother. As a 34-year-old, with everything I ever wanted. But I got to work. And I didn't know if I was going to make it, but I got to work. I was in with a counselor the next day. I started to share with people, Fred White being one of the first, what was really going on with me in my life. My faith deepened. I had a life coach. I started medication. And I realized, I told myself, if I'm not going to make it, at least it's not going to be because I didn't try. They told me that the medication would take about a month. before it really kicked into your system and you would feel better. And I felt about this much better every day. Sometimes I'd take a backslide. Sometimes I felt a little bit better. But it was the night before the last game of the season in 2005. We were in Toronto. And I'd been on medication for 1 month and 1 day. I was looking at that calendar every day. I'm going to feel better on this day. I'm going to feel better on this day. It was all about the medication kick. I'm going to feel better on this day. And I had a high school teammate, when he went away to college, Sean Fitzpatrick, who took his own life. And the only thing I know about it to this day was that he wrote a letter to his family. And in the letter, he said, I just wanted to go be with God. That he had lost hope on earth, but there was enough faith there that he felt like, you know what, I can't do this anymore. I'm dragging everybody down, but I just want to go be with God. And I never forgot that. And I was lying in bed the night before the last game of the season in 2005 in Toronto. And I had a conversation with God. I was doing most of the talking. But I got to a point where I literally said, you know, if I did what Fitzy did, are you and I still good? Like, do I still get to go to you if I decide I can't do this anymore? Because I couldn't do this anymore. And I was scared to death of the off season. Usually the off season's great. I mean, it's like a marathon runner. I was talking to the guys last night at dinner. Like, you don't run a marathon. Anyone run a marathon in here? Okay, you don't run a marathon unless you like running a marathon, right? But did you ever come to the finish line and go, man, I wish there was 5 more miles? No. Okay, that's my job. I wouldn't do this for 30 years if I didn't love it, and I do love it, and I'm grateful for the responsibility the Royals gave me. But I look forward to running through that yellow tape at the end of the year and going home and being with my family. All of a sudden, I wasn't looking forward to that because I was going to be in an empty house all by myself, and the walls were talking to me. And the enemy, he had me right where he wanted me, in that house all by myself. And I'm lying in bed, and I ask God, if I do what Fitzy did, are we good? And the response that I got was, yeah, we're good. But will you allow me to do something with this? Will you allow me to do something with this? Now, I'd love to tell you that I woke up the next morning and I felt great. One of the worst days of my depression was the next day. And I don't know how I got through that broadcast. And I got home and I just got to my house and I just put my face in my pillow and I just cried. I mean, I'm not going to get better. However, will you allow me to do something with this? Help me keep going. About a month into that off season, I was dating a girl, and she was in a position in her life at that time where she's very high profile. We were put together probably for all the wrong reasons, and we'd been together for a couple months, and she was going in one direction, and I was dealing with my stuff that was going on, and I realized one of the first things I need to do is I need to end this relationship and I need to spend more time on me and not put on this facade for her. And on November 1st, 2005, I drove out to her house and we ended the relationship. And I'll never forget driving down the street and she's sitting in my car and we talked it out, went to the back of the car, we hugged it out, I left. I remember seeing her in my rearview mirror as I was driving away, and I remember saying to God, you know, I'm not just driving away from her, like I'm driving away from all of this. I want to do this the way you want to do this. Starting to feel a little better. I want to do this. That was November 1st, 2005, the day after Halloween. We lost 106 games that year, by the way. So I sucked. The Royals sucked. That year was just, it was awful. Everything was awful about it. But I told God that day, I want to do it. I want to do it your way. I'm driving away from so much right now. 10 years to the day, I'm married to my best friend. I have 4 kids, and I am saying into a microphone, the Royals are World Series champions. Ten years to the day. Along the way, I shared my struggle with depression publicly. Many of you, you know, who are baseball fans know who Jeff Passan is with ESPN. Well, he was with the Kansas City Star before he got a job with Yahoo Sports and ESPN, and he wrote a story in spring training of 2006 when I opened up about my depression. In 2009, I wrote a book with Jeffrey Flanagan, who is a longtime writer in Kansas City and beat writer for the Royals, about my depression. And it's because I realized, not that I'm an author, but I realized that because of my platform and because of what I learned about my depression, that this was going on all around me. And I knew that if I shared my story, I might be able to help someone else with theirs. That's the only reason why I wrote that book. I get married, we have kids, the Royals win the World Series. I'm often asked to speak at events like this because of my faith, because of my struggles through depression. My life has changed quite a bit, to say the least. And then I get a phone call in October of 2017. And I wish I had saved this voicemail. But a lady named Rachel Segovia called and said, "Ryan, my name is Rachel. I work for the city of Lee's Summit. Every year, the mayor has a breakfast at John Knox Village. If any of you are familiar with Kansas City, it's a retirement community, and they have this huge pavilion. And the mayor has a breakfast every year. And he was wondering if you'd be the keynote speaker." I was like, "Wow, that's great. These are my people. These are my neighbors. And there's going to be school kids there. And if you want to bring your son," at this time we had all four of our kids have been born, but our son was in kindergarten. "If you want to bring him too, and it's a breakfast and all stuff." Oh, great. So I called her back and I said, "Hey, thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it. What's the date?" January 25th. So I get my phone out, not thinking. And I can tell you, when I look at my phone right now, last day of drinking, January 25, is one of the things that comes up on this date. But I wasn't thinking about that at the time. So I thought, wow, okay, that's an important date. Oh, 1998, 2018. Wow, that's 20 years to the day. Okay. Well, as I did with Mitch, whenever I do an event like this, I want to know, what is your church talking about? What's the theme of the event? So I asked Rachel, "What's the theme?" "It's the mayor's character breakfast." Now, I wish I could tell you that I remembered that prayer for those 20 years. I didn't. I never forgot that day. I never forgot that night. I never forgot how I felt. But I'd kind of forgotten about that prayer until she said it was the mayor's character breakfast. But God didn't forget that prayer. And he used that event to remind me that he didn't forget about that prayer. So what do you think I talked about at that breakfast that morning? And if I'm getting emotional now, you can only imagine how I was on that day. There was 500 people there, including my wife, my parents, and my son, who was in kindergarten. And my son loves biscuits and gravy. And so he said, "Dad, will you get me some biscuits and gravy?" So on my way to get him biscuits, well, we went up to the buffet together, but like every kid, he filled up his plate like a mountain. And at the end was the biscuits and gravy, and he had no room. So we sit down, and he says, "Will you go get me some biscuits and gravy?" So on my way back to the buffet, I talked to this person, I talked to this person, I talked to that person, and then the MC of the event comes on and says, "Hey, welcome everybody. We're going to get to Ryan in just a moment. But first, like Liam, want to go with the announcement, something, and I better get to the stage." So I get to the stage. I tell this story in front of everybody. It took me a lot longer to get through it. I get a standing ovation from 500 people in the room. I go sit down. My mom's proud. My stepdad's proud. My wife rubs my neck, tells me how proud she is. And my son says, "You didn't get me my biscuits and gravy." So, the moral of that story is, I made a promise to God that if he ever asked me to do something on January 25th or November 1st, that I don't have a choice. That's where he wants me to be. So I'm glad to be here today. I have always said that if you listen, if I sat down with any one of you and we listen to all 9 innings of one of my broadcasts, I could say, "Yeah, I stole that idea from this guy," or, "I heard this guy say something and I thought that was a good idea, and oh, I learned that from this broadcaster and I love saying that in this situation." I don't know in 30 years like what's mine and what's original, or if I've just like I just plagiarize every night on the air, just learning from other broadcasters, listening to other broadcasters, not trying to copy them and steal their line, but just take what I've learned works for them and try and apply it to my life. And so I just want to share some things with you today as a husband and a father that I've learned from other people that I use as disciplines today, or I try to use as disciplines today. And a lot of these things have just been redefined for me over the years just based on what season of life I'm in. We have 4 kids, a 9th grader, a 7th grader, a 5th grader, and a 4th grader. Boy, 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 girl. And my wife and I will be married 17 years next month, and she's getting ready for her 18th baseball season. My wife is not a sports fan at all. She's become a sports fan because of my kids, but my wife was a trauma nurse at Children's Mercy Hospital. When she retired to raise our kids, she volunteers twice a week now. One day a week for the same organization, one day a week at a clinic for the homeless and uninsured. And on Thursdays, she goes into homeless camps to serve people who live in tents, who live in shelters. They treat stab wounds, bullet wounds, hypothermia. Unfortunately, she runs into a lot of people who are trafficked. 4 or 5 women in a 1-person tent who are drugged out because that's what they do with the women there. And this ministry made the decision years ago that they're just going to do medical care and that people will trust them to do medical care if that's all they do and there's not the threat of the police. But the things that my wife has seen professing in her life, like broadcasting a baseball game. And I remember the early years of our marriage when we were struggling. We struggled the first 2 years. We'd be in the grocery store and someone would come up and say, "Oh, I watch you every night on TV." And, you know, and say to my wife, you know, "Oh, we love your husband." And, you know, and walk away. And my wife would be like, "Yeah, I wonder if you loaded their dishwasher, if they'd still love you the way that they do when they watch you on a..." So, but there's based on the season of my life, certain things mean different things to me. There's a quote I'm guessing most of you have heard, especially my age and older, from Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill once said, "When you find yourself going through hell, keep going." Now, if you're like a manly man kind of a, you know, that's just like a, yeah, keep going. You know, it's a great thing to say in the huddle, you know, when you're down by 21, you know, or your team's struggling, "Hey, let's keep going. You know, this is not the way we want to go, but let's keep going." And I just kind of ignore. I used to have a book of quotes, and I wrote that down, I don't know, 30 years ago. But recently, I began to realize that when we find ourselves going through hell, yeah, keep going, but there are other choices when you find yourselves going through hell that really have helped me explain, like, why I got stuck. When you find yourself going through hell, you can go back from where you came from. Go back to where you came from. And for many men, unfortunately, when we find ourselves going through hell and we realize what it's going to take to go through hell, we begin to feel like, you know, the cure might be more painful than the disease. And so I found myself going through hell quite a bit, but I didn't want to go there. So I just kind of find a way to turn around and go back out where I came back in. The one that has been so fascinating to me, and especially in our culture today, is that some people find themselves going through hell and they decide, you know what? I think I'm just going to sit here for a while. C.S. Lewis talks about this in his book, Mere Christianity, and he talks about people will tell themselves that they're waiting, but they're really just camping there. They have no intention of getting out of there. In fact, we might start inviting other people to come in this hell with us, and we can kind of commiserate together. This isn't so bad. You know, there aren't any rules in here either, too. And I think there is a culture now that tells people, well, you're not really going through hell right now. This is just who you are. And it's probably not your fault. It's probably someone else's fault. So don't blame yourselves. And we can all look at our lives, me in particular, and think of times in our life where we were victimized in some way. Something happened to us that was beyond our control. And we had no choice about our victimization. However, as grown men now, we do have a choice as to whether we want to label ourselves as a victim or not. So when you find yourself going through hell, keep going doesn't just mean you're taking a step forward. The hardest part about when you're going through hell and keep going is it means that the people that we've blamed, rightly or wrongly, are off the hook. Our decisions now are our decisions. Our bad choices as men are our bad choices. Not theirs anymore. Victimized? Yes. Am I going to walk around wanting to be treated like a victim? No. That's the one thing that has to be let go. Tim Keller once said, the longer we stay here, the more you interpret all the events as supporting what you always believed anyway. And when things go wrong, you blame others and circumstances for your problems. This hardens your heart rather than softening it, and it makes you less open to counsel than ever. That was me. Another way, this is a tough one to wrap your brain around, me too. Another way to find yourself in hell and to stay there is by just completely pouring yourself into serving others. And this feeling that if I can help somebody else, that's going to help me. And the truth is, in most cases, that's temporary. And we all know people who started out helping other people, then they started helping out more people, then they started helping out more people, and they started helping out more people. And then you find out their story, like, where does this come from, this giving and this serving others? And it comes from a hurtful place. And they don't usually like to talk about it. There's a reason why on an airplane they tell you to put your mask on first before you put someone else's mask on. Somebody told me once, you cannot give to somebody else what you don't already have first. And so, as a follower of Jesus Christ, I am not, make this clear, downplaying the importance of serving other people. But you will be able to serve people in ways you never imagined if you serve yourself first. Not become self-serving. But you can love others a lot better when you love yourself first. And in order to love yourself first, we all have to come to terms with the person who created us, who we are, and allowed us to go through some difficult times. I was reading scripture today, Philippians 1:12, basically says, I understand now that all these things that were done to me were done so to advance the gospel. And I'm pretty sure Paul wasn't talking about going to Disneyland and getting to go to the Super Bowl and a Taylor Swift concert. I'm assuming he's talking about like some really bad things. I understand now that these things that were done to me were done to advance the gospel. I learned this too. Two very important words. Therefore, or nevertheless. Okay, my parents were separated when I was 18 months old. They were divorced by the time I was 4. I never saw my mom and dad love each other. I only saw them hate each other. I had people compare me my whole life to my father because he was a major leaguer. There was nothing I could do right on a baseball field because I was always going to be compared to him. And if I was good, I was supposed to be good. And if I had a bad day, there was no excuse because my dad was a major league player and a major league manager. Therefore, I have the right to fill in the blank. I had to replace therefore with nevertheless. My parents were separated when I was 18 months old. They were divorced. They hated each other. I had the pressure of my dad. It was really hard being a baseball player. No matter what I did wasn't good enough. Da-da-da-da-da. Nevertheless, I don't have the right to make my hell somebody else's hell. I don't have that right. So whatever rant you have in your head, and I still have them. I have some great debate. I work on we have some acreage where we live, and I love getting outside and trimming trees and burning brush, and I have these great debates with people that I'm in conflict with, and I win every single one of those debates, every single time. They never have a comeback as I'm just going on and on in my head. And in the end, I always feel like the Holy Spirit goes, nevertheless, therefore versus nevertheless. Keep going. Keep going, by the way, doesn't mean running around in circles and ending up at the same place. I had a friend, a girlfriend, and when I was going through my depression, she was in my life at the time. And she had this hang up for this guy, but she knew it was a bad relationship and she was trying to get out of it. And she would say to me all the time, I prayed to God tonight that he would make me strong enough